remember, you remember I did say that the minister had communicated with us a letter in terms of the acting appointment, and you didn't add that to the agenda. But this is just informal at the Bulgarian. And then I was thought we wanted to start at 8:10, and it was now 4:15. So we started. Right. Okay, let's get the agenda underway. And we need to have this to be prepared. Yes, get this over the top of nothing. We're going to be just a look at our data. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's the exact thing. Well, many companies can tell us.
You should push the meeting to the office.
And then so you can tell the Honourable Collado we've got a court. So because he's falling, he's trying to get the ANC to stay somewhere else. Okay, so we can start now. Okay, well, if you get on with the business of the agenda, good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming here early. Thank you very much. We have only got two items on the agenda. I need to add one tiny item. And by the time I finish speaking, you will have received a copy of a letter written by the Minister, Dr. Rob Davies, with respect to the Triple E Commission. All right, so opening, we've got apologies from medical, long-standing medical apologies from the Honourable Mark Tush. We've got a new medical apology from the Honourable Williams. And we have an apology, what kind of apology from Mr. Right. So we've got those two members on a party business. Can you write a formal letter to the Honourable Shabambu? We haven't had a formal apology from him now for the last four meetings. And we need to get that, otherwise the member is marked absent, as you know. So if we could ask him to send an apology, ask the office, or we get a formal apology and then send someone else. Before we adopt the agenda, I need to put this letter from the minister on the agenda. It concerns the Triple E Commission. Alright? And then we put that on now, right now, before we deal with the investment. Alright. So we'd like to welcome the DG, Mr. Manuel October. We'd also like to welcome Mr. Eunice Wilson, who's the acting head investment clearing house. Alright? And now can we please have someone per course beside you to adopt an adoption of the agenda with the additional short item. Thank Honourable Hilda, seconded by Honourable Bruno. Have you all got the letter in front of you now, copy? Right. You can see it's a very short letter. The minister had indicated to me that they didn't just want to put anyone there, and they have not yet been able to find anyone from the advertising sector. Is that correct, Gigi? Yes.
The effort was placed, and we received many applications in the shortlisting process and so on, but it yielded no quicker than necessary competency, and that's why a request was then made from the internal panel that the minister approaches one of the senior officials in the DTI or in government to at least head up the establishment while we try to seek a permanent.
And consequently, the GDG of Consumer and Corporate Regulation Division, and that is Ms. Woodbeck and Tooley, has been seconded from that position to serve as acting commissioner to the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Commission, effective on the 1st, but it has not been not someone who has to start from A, B, C. But can we have someone to post as the confirmed minister on this? Thank you, Honourable Palakul, seconded by the Honourable, yes, and call me. So there we are. I'm just going to sign this off to go back, that it was a meeting held on the 14th.
So that is usually a good indicator.
we are. Final point that is, final 2 points, is that we must identify what are the fundamental forces that drives investment. And I think important to note, investments are not here for charity. They are here driven by fundamentally how much profit or how much returns they're going to get from the people that invest. So they are driven by the cost structure in the economy and domestic demand. What is the demand for their products and what is the cost structure? As they say in economics, part by the sea, revenue minus cost equals profits. So therefore, one must look beyond sentiment and look at beyond the headlines and just look at whether an investment is profitable in your economy. And then finally, the issue, a very important issue, which I will say, and that's why we have our acting VD here for investment promotion, which is about we must ensure that we cut out all red tape with regard to investment, and secondly, that we have regulatory efficiencies, that the turnaround times for issuing of work permits, of water licenses, of electricity connections, of EIAs is done quickly, and we have put in place a system now, a one-stop shop, a clearing house, which is already started, and the units get up that region in the department. So they turn to the investment trends. And if you look at the top graph there, that will indicate, as I indicated, cross-domestic fixed investment. And as you can see, that post the financial crisis, you can see we are clearly on an upward trend. And that is where we're talking about the 20%. We're heading towards, and as you can see, this is steadily growing, our cross-domestic fixed investment. And that is the reason that our minister has indicated we are confident. From what we hear, both from investors coming to the country that we meet with every day, but also from the statistics, which shows that we are, you can see an upward trend, and we have had a really good year in 2013, and also a good year in 2014 of investment. Gross domestic investment is coming up 620 billion and is invested. Secondly, if you look at the bottom one, which is the foreign direct investment. So the top is total investment, both domestic and foreign. The bottom one is just foreign investment, and there, as you can see, is South Africa is showing impressive growth in the FDI. In the 2 years, 2013-2014, we attracted 140 billion rand investment in this country. 140 billion rand. And that is an investment almost every 2 weeks in this country where a new investor investing in South Africa. Now I think, and this is where I want to caution about the media headlines. Now what happened, as you can see, is a slight fall between 2013 and 2014. Now in this report in the press, it says investment falls in South Africa. But now you can see even 2014 is double what it was in 2012. But it was a few percentage points lower. The reason was we had massive investment in, we had historically high investments in 2013, a slight decline in the speed of investment. But as I indicated to you, that it is still double that of 2013, 2012 and so on. So what we have is really clearly, investors, foreign investors are having confidence in the country. They are putting their money into plant and machinery and equipment, or they are buying South African firms, mainly in the manufacturing sector, and so on. So, then I think what is important to note again, people, as I said, maybe there is sort of an urban myth that investment doesn't take place in South Africa. So, as I said, South Africa's FDI stock, this is used by OECD and UNCTAD, is 42%. That means 42% of our economy is owned by foreign investors. Now that is very, very high, even by international standards. The average in the world, in Europe, is about 25%. So South Africa has one of the highest proportions of FDI in its domestic economy. But also, many of the multinationals you work with are not new to South Africa. If you take Unilever as an example, they go of the first liberal ballots actually for Elizabeth in the 1920s. So they, many of them have been here for 100 years or more in the country. Many of them have been here for 50 years or more. Unilever, Nestle and others. So therefore, what many of them are doing is pensions. So in a sense, I think it has. And I'll show you the other figures later on. But also the other reason is South Africa has very sophisticated and deep financial markets. So it's very easy for investors to raise capital in domestically for the investment. So as I said, that is the picture of the API. The other point about why that's why I said it was really important that we take this presentation, is that the private sector, we are a mixed market economy, but it's really a fundamentally private sector driven economy, which is over 60% plus domestic investment. So the rest is government and the rest is SOEs. But the fundamental driver. So our analysis is, if we're going to increase the GDFI to 50%, you must principally drive private sector investment, and then as a corollary to that, you must drive SOE investment. Now, I think again, it's also important to distinguish between the different subsectors of the economy. For example, currently we are facing massive headwinds in the mining industry because of the drop in demand from China and the falling commodity prices. So I think what you will see here in the bottom slide is the three different sectors of mining, agriculture, and manufacturing. And you will see that mining, we don't expect, because the commodity super cycle is over, with the high prices that we achieve for coal and iron ore, immediately after the financial crisis is not going to continue any longer, because as the minister constantly indicates, China is on a different growth path now. It is not commodity intensive. Therefore, our growth has to come from these other two sectors, which is agriculture, agro-industries, and manufacturing. We are mainly, we have to start growing FDI in those sectors. And as I said, you will see that investment is actually falling in the mining industry. But that is because of global trends. But also it's important to know that because we have over-reliance on the mining sector, there's linkages between different parts of the economy. So a large part of the construction industry and of the manufacturing industry supports and supplies the mining industry. And that's why you currently have a crisis in the steel industry, especially because the mines are no longer building new mines. So they're not buying manufacturing equipment. And therefore, there will be a decline, impact on manufacturing. I think that the broad kind of point we're making is that all sectors are interlinked and so on, but we must break down the trends and so on. The positive thing in the bottom side again, which as I said is so important, is the manufacturing investment has recovered relatively strongly after 2010. You can see that in the green. Again, as I said, we need to do much more work, but the other sector that we must grow because of the demand for food globally is that we must move on to agriculture. Now, looking at the different parts of investment trends, private sector, state-owned companies, and so on. As I indicated, there is growth in the private sector, but not at the level that we want to achieve the 5% growth. But as I said, we're still at a good point of 20.3% in 2014, but as I said, it's not sufficient to grow at 5%. If you look again, you will see that the one part of government spending that has been strong is government spending. That is because it's spending on schools, hospitals, clinics, and so on. So general government spending is positive, but as I said, it only makes up about 10% of gross domestic fixed investment. It has also been positive because of the electricity, especially on the spending on the renewable energy, has been strong, but on the other hand, investment levels for finance and business services is modest and down. This is just looking at the future trends. They expect an increase in general government expenditure. This is the IDC analysis. But again, the worrying feature here is there seems to be a slowing down of public corporations. Only 0.9%. I think again here, private sector is forced us to grow at 6.3%. So from the private sector, so again, this mythology about a private sector strike, investment strike is also not true and not borne out by facts. Private sector investment is growing, 6.3%, it will increase to 6.3%. And I said, obviously, if you have 5% growth, that push that to about 10% growth. But it is growing, but not growing fast enough. And so this also just gives you a further breakdown of the components of fundings from a private sector into different subsectors of the economy. We cannot spend too much time on that. I want to then just again turn to again the analysis of the FDI flows. I thought we'll give you a full picture of, as I said, what is the cumulative FDI stock in South Africa, which is the bottom. The bottom one, and as you can see from 2003, you can see the massive increases and consistent increases of FDI flows into the country, and you can see it really that you can pick up, especially from after 2008, and which really points to the positive picture for FDI. Also important is with regards to, again, the story about the continent. You'll see later on in the slide, South Africa still, as we know, the new investment destination of the continent. South Africa still gets the lion's share and still the largest recipient of FDI onto the continent. So people are still using South Africa as a base for expansion and for as the principal gateway onto the continent. This is a survey not by government, but by Ernst & Young, released earlier this year in Island Corvette. Now, if we take there, again, as you can see, the ways that people report, what they talk about, FDI project numbers fall in 2014, but capital investment and job creation surge. That means Africa is still attracting significant amounts of investment. And all of that, if you take the corner there, South Africa remains on top. The top destination for FDI projects in 2014 was South Africa. It has received twice as many FDI projects as any other African country. Now why is that? Because South Africa offers an adverse economy. We're the only economy on the continent that has such a diverse agriculture, agro-processing, manufacturing, mining, financial services, and tourism industry compared to the rest of the country. Second thing here, as I said, as we still complain about our infrastructure, but we have the best infrastructure. On the continent, we have solid infrastructure, and our ease of doing business is there. So this is just again to explain that that's why we are confident about the short, medium, and long term, is because Africa is a growing continent, and we are showing that we are still by far the leading investment destination of the continent. This to give you again about companies that have come to South Africa and are invested here, and many of them have come since 1994. The United States has 700 companies doing business in South Africa, the UK 600, Germany 600, Japan 280, France 185, India 120. This is again just to deal with the facts and not with the mythology that investors are running away from the country. This just gives you again, we had a very, very strong spike in Japanese investment. The Japanese have defined Africa as the next growth frontier. And they are expanding their investment, and this just shows some of the stance undertaken by the Japanese JFRO. But again, it's expanding, but it's not only the Japanese, it's also the Indian investment. This just gives you some real examples of the investment pipeline and some of the future of what we expect. As I said, in 2014, our investment pipeline was $43 billion. And as you know, Unisys division, they monitor each and every investment which comes into the country. They work with those investors, walk them through all the regulatory minefields. Nestle loses electricity, Bangladesh, because of the municipality. It is Unisys and his team that goes out there to ensure that the municipality supplies electricity to Nestle and to Unilever and others. This is our highlights. As I said, just to give some highlights, obviously one of the biggest investors is one of the biggest companies in the world, Unilever. Minister just opened a plant a few weeks ago in Boxburg, but they have increased $4 billion, and they've expanded 4 new plants in the country over the past 2-3 years. It's tough to explain the Western Cape, and they are in the renewable energy field. They made a $220 million. Toyota have just completed the volume of a new taxi, new vehicle plant, which they're adding to their range, over 10,000 people employed in Toyota. Then we had Samsung, which has now set on the roofs, first ever investment from Samsung directly in the country, the Dubai Chakra, in Chakra Airport. Then we also had in the call center industry, we've had a big investment in CCI call centers, we've even had in the hospitality sector, Vodafone, and PLC. We're just giving the variety of sectors, but as you said, there's substantial foreign investment in manufacturing, advanced manufacturing, but also especially the growing services sector. This one also just again is a breakdown of the figure. And again, as you said, this one gives you just the overall investment change. It will take over a very long period of time, which as you said, how we must see it. But as you can see, there's the financial crisis in 2008. So you can see since the 2000s, things start picking up. Now, the last time we had serious growth in the country was in the in the 70s and early 80s. Then there was the decline through the dark period of our history, sanctions period and Rubicon and so on. And you see the fall off and so on. Then you see in the 90s it starts picking up, and it really only starts picking up in 2000s. But this is really driven by commodity cycle, and this is driven also by debt and consumption spending in 2000. And then you have the financial crisis. And then you have the dip in investment, and then now you see the pickup. So this explains a lot of why we see this sort of opinions around FDI trends and so on, because if you take it a few years back, yes, there was a fall in investment in the middle of the financial crisis, but as I said, our, the indications are all that we are now on our trajectory. This is also just top 10 FDI stocks in Africa, and there, as you can see again, by far South Africa is at the bottom. We are way ahead in terms of this unpaid report, which is about South Africa. The other slide just gives a breakdown of who are the big investors in South Africa. Back in 2014, just as a snapshot, you will see the biggest investment is still our oldest historical partner of the United Kingdom, making up the major part of it. 32% is from the United Kingdom, and as you know, one of their biggest investors is Vodafone. And also Unilever is an Anglo-Dutch company, but it is now mainly a British company. So that is Unilever, that is the Vodafone in Vodacom. So then you have the United States also as a big investor, which comes second is 23%, and that is your big Procter & Gamble, your GE starting to invest. Also in the IT and pharmaceutical sectors is in the United States. And so, and then you...
Okay, Ron, GE. You've only got the two brands. You've got the UK on the left.
Yes.
Then you've got one on the right. Who's that investor?
Which one?
It's the China. Color green that you've on the right.
China.
Thank you.
China.
That's China.
China.
Okay. And what capital city?
30.
Okay.
Okay. So, as I indicated, and those trends are likely to continue because still your biggest, the companies are the biggest sectors in these areas. As you can see today, straight by Amazon, Facebook, everybody's now coming. Here again, it's just some figures, a number of projects. This is FDI, taking the number of projects, and as you can see, South Africa is 116 projects. And then you can see again, even the next biggest African country we're taking at GS 43, we still double the number of FDI projects compared to Nigeria and so on. Then just to say we are working vigorously then to implement the National Development Plan, and the National Development Plan speaks a lot about diversification and talks about us reaching the goal of 50% of gross domestic investment. So I think we must understand we face some legacy challenges, some big challenges with regards to attracting, to raising this level of foreign investment and domestic investment. The biggest obstacle now is that there's been underinvestment in energy, in our roads, in our rails, and our ports. And these are the main bottlenecks to expansion. And I think the biggest one, as you can see, has been the energy, and that is why it's a central part of the national plan to address the energy challenge. But it's not only the energy challenge, there's also a challenge in terms of rail infrastructure. Many companies to get their goods to Durban, they have to put them on trucks instead of on rail. Even the people are putting even mineral products on things, so that is our biggest constraint. If we can deal with the constraint of infrastructure, we can boost, we can reach the target of what. And just turning to some of the more local projects, the other one is, as you know, one of our biggest drivers for even raising the level of FDI is the IEZ, or the Special Economic Zones. This just gives a very quick update on where we are. And as you know, we currently have six industrial development zones, the last ones being Saldanha and Dube, and now we've done one in Harrismith. But this is the report card, and it's basically currently there are 59 investors on site already now producing goods and services, and they have attracted 10 billion rand. Then in the final one, we give the subsectors. As you know, for example, in the Eastern Cape, in Kuba, they've got quite a diversified range from business processes and call centers, right to first automotive works. The Chinese have built building cars in Kuba zone, but also we have agro processing, but also we have the Indians doing steel and in the Kuba, so it's a mixed bag. It's London, it's mainly automotive. And then, as I said, Saldanha, those things, as I said, there was an announcement yesterday, but it's oil and gas and so on. But again, we expect these numbers will also start to be growing quite fast as we move on the IDJ program. This is the profile of investment in the special economic zones. As I said, the biggest investors are still foreign investors, but they don't make up more than 33% or 30%. FDI is the 50% in Kuka and 37% in Islanda. Then we're making good progress of finalizing all regulations. The goal is now established for the special economic zones. We have also have a full-time secretariat supporting this. But also, we are nearing completion on the feasibility studies for the 8 new special economic zones. And so, as I said, Free State has already gone to cabinet and has been approved, and that one is moving quite fast in management. It should be launched on the next quite soon. There's also good progress on Mosina investment. There's also very strong progress in Atlantis, in the Western Cape as the next zone, and then also Africa. you mentioned that there's strong investment in Mosina, which we hope to launch as the next one. There's strong investment shown by Chinese companies, and as I indicated, the other ones, Huffington and Atlantis, which should be going to cabinet in the next three to 4 months. Again, as I said, we've covered, I've covered the one about Manufi on the call. It's the one that has been completed, and we only expect two big investments that have already been sort of confirmed. And there are this is the final paperwork, but that is the Toyota expansion and then the production of entry electrolytes and so on. Then let me just mention to what we are doing to really now fast track the FDI and so on. As I said, it was decided as part of the 9-point plan that we would establish this one-stop shop for investment clearinghouse. It's for that reason that we created the new division in the department where we have a full-time person working just on investment and not working with FDI. So that central number operational structure will be located in the department, but it will have very, very strong links and nodal points to the Department of Home Affairs so that we can immediately process visa and work permit applications. It will have a nodal point with the Department of Environment so that we can speed up environmental certificates, and it will have a nodal point in the Department of Water Affairs so that we have water licenses being issued. So it will be, so what we are creating, and I think Eunice has also just been to Hangad and to Singapore, so that we can take all these things, these processes online, so that we have an e-governance system for the issuing of licenses. But the key thing is to create these regulatory efficiencies and one-stop shop, and also part of it will be located in the presidency as well, so that we can get full cooperation of all departments, but that we really speed up the processes. So what we want to also establish is clear standards. So for example, we say EIA must be issued within 6 months. A water license must be processed within 3 months. And the electricity connection must be done in 1 month. Work permits must be issued on some stages and so on. But this is investment best factors, and this is what, as I said, this is what UNIS is now occupying with in terms of establishing this one-stop shop. The one-stop shop will also be working with the one-stop shops within the IDAs. And then it will be working with provinces. We already have got a Gauteng investment center. So it will be working with all the provinces so that we have a smooth window for investors when they come into the country. So this is just one of the approaches which again puts the value proposition for South Africa. And as I said, South Africa is a compelling value proposition for foreign investors. Firstly, under the rankings of the World Economic Forum, we are number one in the world for our auditing and reporting standards. We are number one for the efficacy of our corporate boards. There's strong corporate governance structures. We are number one in terms of the Companies Act that we passed recently for the protection of minority shareholders. And we are number one, and as you saw the headlines of the business day today, the regulations of our stock exchange. And we are number one for legal rights. We are number two for our availability. As I indicated, South Africa is a very, very strong financial sector. And we're sound number three for the soundness of our banks. Number 10 for investor protection. Number 11 and so on. So what we will be going on a reinvigorated marketing drive. As we indicated when we launched the special economic zones and the new SGN Act, We are combining the marketing operation for all our economic zones so that we present one value proposition for the country. Let me then just turn to our challenges in terms of even taking our investment to the 50%. The biggest one is our regulatory inefficiencies, and many of them differ across provinces. As I said, in Gauteng now you can get the EIA in under even 3 months, 6 months you can get the EIA. In some some provinces you can get an electricity connection in the Western Cape, and in Free State you can get an electricity connection within 1 month, and so on. So what we want to do is we want to standardize these electricity issues across the country so that we can present one compelling case to investors. So a lot of work is being done on the regulation of fee efficiencies. The other one is a question of demand conditions. Companies are really active to sell their products, and so we must stabilize our demand conditions in the country. And then, as I said, the other biggest one is the infrastructure constraints. Dealing with energy, I think there's a plan for energy. We need to get a similar strong plan for health. Already, I think the upgrading of our ports are stopping quite fast now. We saw in Saldana, they stopped with the construction, also Richard's Bay, but we need that to move across everybody to improve the efficiency of our ports and so on. And then the final one is we must ensure that we increase the localization opportunities. As you know, if you take the automotive industry as an example, many of them, or all of them, they invest because of the South African market. So BMW, let's say, is not here because they are South African, they are here because they want to sell BMWs. But they can just import those BMWs and get it from their plants in the majority. By crafting our incentives in such a way, we must ensure that they localize not only the assembly, but more and more the components as well. So therefore, we must strictly tie localization, but we must understand that you first have to attract the foreign investment. And so even if they come in by doing basic assembly, we want to start off with basic assembly, and then after 10, 20 years, you can move into more deepening of it. But it takes 20, 30 years to create the industry, as Nigeria is learning now. You have to start with basic assembly, and even though people say it isn't deep enough, the investment, you cannot have component manufacturing without assembly. So you must start off by attacking the investment in key areas, and then over time you use a localization opportunities. And okay, I think that concludes the presentation. Just a final thing, there is now a strong internship. We had a really good meeting on Friday, passed with the Presidential Business Working Group. It is now the responsibility has given to the Minister of Trade and Industry to be the overall convener for this, and this is where we are working with business in different areas. In two big areas we have crossed things. One is on regulations. We are working with business on and Bobby Godson, others with some there, Jacqueline Marie and others, and then we are working also on education and skills. It's the other big area that we're working on, and then the other one is obviously stabilizing the labor nation's environment. As I said, foreign investors expect us to have a conducive labor nation's environment, and so that is also one of the issues dealt with in the working I won't go into that, but I think the work is being done, and I think people have been reporting on the issue of the electricity.
Members, and thank you. You're back again, yes. We'll get to hear from. Thank you. All right. Now, I think it was really one of the more up-to-date presentations we've received on the investment. Thank you very much, DG. And you certainly know your way around these figures. Members, let's engage on this. Commentary. This is a very valuable presentation that is going to assist us going forward. So any comments, any questions, etc. Honourable Quirnell, followed by the Honourable Phil Lewis, the Honourable Isabella, the Honourable Colby, the Honourable Calado, in that order. And, you've got this time on your side, so stretch it to 4 minutes. All right, back. Honourable Cook.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, it's funny that we're doing this later part on the Friday morning. It is a good presentation, and I want to thank the department for this. You know, the Institute for Security Studies is having a seminar item today, and they just launched a very interesting paper on South Africa. And what they say is we may experience some turbulence, but not a storm yet. And then they say that the perennial sense of crisis in the media is not supported by the deeper analysis of the structural conditions in our economy. And I think that is true. Unfortunately, we always highlight the bad news and we don't take the big effects. It's a very good part, a very good study, and obviously my friend here on my right today will say that they're also saying that the ANC will be out of power in thought. But, you know, but if you look at that whole paper, it is very interesting paper to read. But if I look at this, the first thing you say, private sector is far more important than you think. You know, 60% of GDPR comes from the private sector. Well, then the private sector becomes your most important partner for growth in South Africa and for employment. And what this paper of IHS, IWS Africa is saying, also that without a new revolution in policy coherence and efficiency behind the show. Now this one stop shop is a fantastic idea, but what I would like to see the Department of Forces after involved is a get out of the silos of departments. You cannot stumble where departments are not working together, and that is it. You know, we don't see the policy coherence. Because of that, I think it is. But thank you very much. Maybe we should invite part of this edge to this committee and they also will think that we can't do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr.
obstacles to investments in South Africa. There was a strong focus on red tape, which I absolutely underscored.
willingness to engage in economic reform. And, you know, this is quite a dramatic deterioration in the fundamental economic and regulatory backdrop in South Africa over the last year. So I think we must be honest about that report and actively seek to address the concerns that it raises and respond to it. And not simply kind of, I think it's the word, around it. Then on the numbers in your presentation,
I'm so sorry, just before you continue, which you are going to, you referred to the Kernet report. Now, I was looking to see when that was referred to, or if it was your reference.
Sorry.
Right, it should be in the Kernet, or right, so please make it available to.
It's probably the best of this meeting, so you can put it across.
If you are going to refer to it in particular, it doesn't need to be up here. It doesn't need to be up here, all right.
Sure, well, it'd be very widely covered. So, I think everyone has seen it by now. And everyone, it is, as I said, very freely available online.
Sorry, I'm just
And then since I joined this committee, that particularly I have reached the community, especially from the life established community. You know, there's nothing good about, you know, what you're presenting is not what I see in the newspaper or the business. What is going to be in the comment of the GAMG. I don't know about it. The wonderful story that we have put now, getting on the current COVID and possibilities, you know, do you intend to have educated unit within the PDI that will communicate these good stories to our people? Since the weekend we have been reporting on the media that is becoming an official position in the country, we're not reporting such stories. But only strange stories are also. The last one, you spoke about the current of our economic side. You said it's a big economy, but it's dominated by the private sector investment, which for me, that private sector establishment is a widespread sector establishment. What are the possibilities? Because here in this economy, we need also to encourage small, medium,
what year you say the age is not going to lead foundation for private sector to offer in that private sector benefits more than anyone else. We of course it has been for us. But for me, we have to look to that. But I'm very happy in that because I'm raising this element of coordination. If we want to deal with red tape, we want our regulations to be very efficient. We want to take decisions on time. As you are saying, investment doesn't wait for you for 3 years to take a decision or implement our policies. Maybe. To me, it means we have to have some centralization of these things. Again, I think one question is how can this, you see this is a very nice feature, and this gives a hope to our economy and to the country. And this problem in our economy of shortage of skills. We sometimes say our economy does not create jobs. But every time we open a paper, there are adverts and there are of different skills. How do we make sure that skills which in the atmosphere are creating a city are there are also skills those departments who have tried years with that. They invest on skills which are needed to the economy. Again, that is a good purpose and it's an area of coordination between the departments. And lastly, how do you relate this very, you know, good feature of our economy? How do you relate it to this level of unemployment, which most of the time is used as a benchmark of saying our economy is not growing, is not providing jobs? How do you relate this, taking into consideration what you have presented to us? Thank you.
Thank you very much. much, Honorable Guest Payton. Just one thing on the, I mean, the recent establishment, restructuring, so if you do now have, or see, you know, that's the person in town.
Reinvestment in us?
That is relatively new units, isn't it, as such? So it's early days to see what positive impact has been, but perhaps in a year's time you'll be able to come back and give us that. I noticed the comments that you made about the Japanese investment here, that it would be quite helpful. I see it's 2014, 280 companies, etc. From what kind of base are we talking about, say, in 2010 or so, 4 or 5 years ago? What are we looking at? Because it would appear from what's in the media that there's an acceleration trend that is getting faster and faster with the build-up upon the Japanese in South Africa. And the kind of areas, manufacturing or FDI investment, what is it that they are investing in? The other point that I would like to raise is with respect to the number of jobs. Certainly in the Statistics A as well, it does show impact that the instability, labor instability has had on the loss of jobs, etc., from various companies, not just mining companies. When you're looking at the SEZ, although its primary purpose is not to create jobs, what can we expect from SEZ? What have we projected as the labour absorption rate here? And will that take a couple of years to kick in? Now, looking short term, medium term, when can we expect a significant number of people to be employed there? And would it be in those skills, medium or across the board? And thank you very much, E.G. We've got 15 minutes max to, for you to respond.
Thank you, Chair. I'll try to be as as possible, although I think the members have raised very important profound issues. I think, Honorable Kunov, I think, yes, I've just read that study by the Institute of Security Studies. I think it's really a very good piece of work. But I think it's, some of the political predictions are very, very comfortable, so to members across the bench there. But I think the important thing about that piece of work is that it starts drawing a distinction between the structural factors in our economy, what we call economics, the fundamentals, and distinguish it from political opinion and contestation. So I think, and I think that the important thing about that institute, Sylvia's study, is that he concurs with the view that the fundamental forces are on our side, and there's two reasons for that. The one is we are part of a growing continent, and we can be the major supplier of agro-processed products and manufactured products for cotton. And that is the source of our growth. And secondly, the demographics is on our side in terms of the size of our population and the labor force and so on. But also the strength of our business class. And as you can see there from, and as I said, maybe the BEE and the stuff is not where you want it to be. But what you have is substantial foreign, foreign-based companies in South Africa, and you have a strong domestic private sector as well. So that is the factor which nobody else on the continent has. And that is why I think that study is really useful reading. And I think I'll come back to the point about policy premiums. Honorable University, as well, thanks for your comments about the intake. As you can see, we really, that is the absolute focus of Mr. Hussein's one-stop shop here in RSY. And as you know, we have started the presentation. This was presented to the Kamela Khotla. Our minister presented this presentation to the Kamela Khotla. As you said, the reason is that we need to move away from silos and we need to create this one-stop shop. So then the Honorable Kalapos point about that you can do as how can it's done. You can issue a VIA. Some of the VIAs are done in 3 months. And also, it can be done if you put in place the proper processes. You aim at doing these things. The thing is this, as I said, the common national standard. Currently, after each province and municipality, we have what it takes on the nation. I think the important thing for Lewis is, I think, which you're raising probably explains a lot of the clearly one about why is there this gap between perception and reality. Because, as you know, I mean, there is this perception that South Africa's economy is fundamentally weak and that we are moving towards doom and gloom. Whereas, as I said, that's completely. I think that probably the interesting one is what Ernst & Young calls here the perception gap. Now, what they have done is they, for example, have surveyed people who are already invested on the continent and those who are not invested. And look at the perception gap. I don't know if you can see the figures there. But for example, if they ask people, what do you think? Do you think things will improve on the African continent? 30% said they think it will improve. These are people who are not invested. Then if you go to the other side and they ask the people who are currently, as I said, those 3,000 foreign companies, what do you think will they improve in Africa? 81% thinks they will improve. And the reason is because they are here, because Nestle is here. And Nestle knows that the consumer market is growing. And therefore they are part of that 81%. So that explains the perception gap. But if you see newspaper reading, sitting in London, and you read The Sun or The Daily Mail, you will think that African continent is just basically on a very, very fast trip. It's not like this continent. So it's not the hope. It's not the rising African narrative which dominates the media. It is a hopeless continent narrative. And I think that explains, and even in our own country, it is not the rising Africa, it is a hopeless continent. We're not confident of hope, hopeless continent. So I think that perception gap, and therefore that anything here is the same thing. As I said, the facts don't lie. And we doubled investments in 2013. But why did we drop off from number one to whatever? The reason is because they changed their methodology, but also they based on perceptions. They sent a survey out to CEOs and they argued, what do you think South Africa is going to be? So, and then we fall down. But as I said, we have to move away from the analysis based on facts. Only the stats must speak. And I think that explains the gap between the rules. There's another survey coming up, FDI Markets, which again looks at Africa. And they said that Africa is number one for ease of doing business on the continent. Number one. But because as you know, in South Africa, as you know, if you have a First National Bank account, you can register a company in 1 day, in 3 hours. Nowhere else can you do that. So I think, as I said, there is an issue. Then I think the coming to Honourable point that also deals with the question of, you asked the question, how FDI is high, is that a bad thing? Foreigners are only the country. And so on. I think it also relates to the earlier point about mergers, acquisitions, and your FDI. I think I start from a proposition that any FDI, if it is, and I think it's a quote from the university, any FDI in the productive sectors of your economy is possible for the country. There can be no bad FDI if it's in manufacturing plants, if it's in agriculture. The only time it can be bad for your country, it could be, for example, like we had with the Walmart thing. If someone comes in, closes down South Africa and doesn't use local producers, then they just use, so it's a retailer, for example, it could go either way. It depends whether the retailer is going to buy local or use his global supply chain. It also means sometimes people take it just for the IP. They just want to be doing intellectual property, they close down the plant and so on. But I think in South Africa we've had a really positive FDI. All our FDI is a positive. Even the positive role that Walmart is playing because of the supply environment. Many, they're getting in our black suppliers into the supply chain. They're exposing our wines in U.S. stores too. And because what the foreigners bring is A, they bring technology, so you always at the cutting edge. Secondly, they bring access. must know that 60% of world trade is amongst multinationals. So if you're not in those multinational chains and networks, so you have to be in the same thing to be in the Toyota's supply chains if you're in the supply. So I think 42% is a positive outcome, and that's why we can be so positive. Because, and as I said, many of these multinationals have been there for a very long time. So that's why I said, so for example, when Procter & Gamble or Nestle or Unilever expand, Toyota, Toyota's been there since 1960. When they expand, it's not a completely new thing. It doesn't look like it's a new headline for the country. It's just an expansion of the same trends. So that's why the perception gap is still there as well. But I think the important point on what is about why does the media point the different picture? I think it's a thing which I think our minister has made it when he presented to Cameron, is that if you ask Nigerians about the economy, no matter whether it's Boko Haram, less electricity, less than 10% of Nigeria's electricity, they are absolutely positive about Nigeria being an economic powerhouse. They have no doubts about it. If you ask anybody in the UK, whether they're talking about immigration or that, you're asking about the strength of the British economy and they're telling you the best way to do business is Britain, with the most open market in Europe. You ask Americans what they say about the economy, they will fight about so many things, but they will tell you that the US is the most powerful economy in the world. And it's only South Africa that we ourselves have the scum growth, which is we join the misery of others. We constantly have different perceptions about our own economy. So I think that's why the Institute of Security Studies is so positive. It's a series of fundamental facts driving it. But I think, as I said, so the perceptions, the sentiment is something we have to deal with, and that's why you will see what we are doing when we maybe present next week, is that we are talking about a common message from the country. We must have South Africans, we must all, like all other countries, we must speak at one message of the economy and need to move the NDPs far over 30% of FDI of gross domestic investment. And then we can fight about, and I think this was under the question, you see, I think people confuse an economic debate about macroeconomic policy, about whether you want austerity or fiscal policy and so on. But other countries don't debate the fundamentals of the economy, the strength about their manufacturing sector, the strength about the agricultural sector. As you could see in the vote talks, right down to the vice president of the U.S. found our deputy president to support chicken from the U.S. As I said, but there are massive disagreements about macroeconomic policy. But they don't disagree about the centrality of the productive sectors of the economy. So I think what we should adopt is a common message. Let's all agree that the way we can grow this economy is now is to dynamize our agricultural and our manufacturing sector, because we neglected those sectors in the past and we haven't supported them sufficiently at stake. We withdraw our support from agriculture in the early 90s. And so I think that also comes into to a point that is Honorable Kalako and I think the chair as well, is that how do we explain this progress you're making, the good story, and the high unemployment in South Africa. Now, I think a very important thing again about economics is that recently with the unemployment rate of 25%, that is not changing much. Because even if we're growing, and as I indicated in another group, we created 6 million jobs since 1994, but the workforce has expanded by more than that. 7-8 million jobs. So more people are coming into the labor market and creating jobs. But every country that has solved its unemployment problem, and ours is one of the biggest we inherited because of high speed. But even if take South Korea, you take a minimum of 30 years of consistent growth to get to full employment. So we must not expect that we can solve the unemployment problem in the next 5 years or 10 years. But what we are saying, if you focus on changing the structure of your economy and you move into agriculture and into manufacturing, and we grow consistently for the next 10, 20 years at about 3, 4, 5% of the, you will then bring your China, South Korea, Japan, even all of them grew by disappears. And actually move on from there. So that's why I think it's important that we have a common message, but we have also an absolute focus, not so much on macro debate stuff, and that can carry on. People can have views about whether they're Keynesians or whether they want to be Friedman and so on. But really, and I think that can change the political cycle. But what mustn't change is our complete focus, as I said, on agriculture and on the chain of conclusion, yes, the new division that Eunice set up, it has been set up since the 9-point plan was adopted, and I think he will be able to give you an update, but let's say a lot of the work he has been doing in NCASE as our chief director for investment promotion, but now he's doing it on behalf of the economic cluster and all the departments, and again on the SSN, I think. Again, as I said, we are making really the pace is getting faster now. As you know, in the past 2 years, we've had Sagana, we had Zube, and we did Addisworth. We've had three IBJs, we hopefully will have another, at least another two, if not three, in the next 6 months. So I think we are working aggressively, but as I said, these investments take time. We can set up a plant that takes a few years to build and construct and stuff, but we have to be patient, and also we must stay the course if we aim to deal with the underlying problems.
Members, because this seems to be a short meeting, they are not in the way of the schedule, may cause it to change. But so I'm not going to come back for a second round of questions, etc. But I'd really like to thank you, DG. And also, I'd like to thank you, Ms. Eunice Wilson. With respect to findings, I just want to indicate that until we hear from the speaker, Friday is a working day in Parliament until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But we are scheduling our Fridays as far as possible to end by midday, as far as possible. But generally, from 8 o'clock, we like it to start and to finish at 10. It enables others to get to Malanga or whatever, so that we obviate the challenges they are. So just for any new members who help us get the data. Thank you very much for being here early, all of you. Thank you. Meeting adjourned until Tuesday meeting. 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock on Tuesday. That's the difference.
Okay.
It's just this one, okay.
I'm very well, thank you so much for having us.
Oh, okay.
Just a few, just a short.